Welcome to the Kona Edge, where you'll discover what the best triathletes in the world do to give them the edge.
Welcome on to this edition of the Kona Edge. I'm Brad Brown. We are smack bang in the middle of the 2016 IM Summit. It's been going fantastically well. If you haven't checked it out yet, do head over to theimsummit.com. We are just about to wrap things up. You can pick up your all-access VIP pass as well and check out some of our incredible speakers. Gee, we've had sessions with Lucy Gossage, the 2016 Ironman UK champion. We've had a session with Pedro Gomez, who finished second at Ironman Lake Placid last weekend. We've also had sessions with Eric Kruger, who is a time management expert, and that is something that comes up time and time and time again when I chat to age group of triathletes just like you, that we all battle with keeping the balls in the air and juggling everything we need to juggle, work, family, and triathlon. And Eric's session was spectacular, so make sure you check that out. Ian Craig as well, functional nutrition for Ironman triathlon. A wonderful session, exactly what you should be doing and shouldn't be doing when it comes to your Ironman nutrition. So if you'd like to get more details, theimsummit.com, that's where you can find them. Be sure to pick up your VIP all-access pass as well. But enough about me yakking on. Let's get into today's podcast, and we head to the UK once again. And I loved the chat I had with our next guest. Let's welcome on Paul Savage. Paul, welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Brad. Thanks for having me on the show.
Paul, it's great to catch up, and I have to laugh because before we started chatting, I thought you're from Manchester. You've got to support either City or United, and you support neither. You're not a big football fan. You're obviously big into your try. Is there anybody else in the UK that's not a big football fan? I can't believe it.
There's a few of us triathletes that can't be bothered with it. Yeah, yeah, too much money in football. I don't like the the wages that the player paid. I don't think they're worth it. So yeah, stick away from that sport and stick with triathlon, where there's no money.
Yeah, too funny there. I was going to say, is that because you don't have much time to sit down and watch a football game for 90 minutes?
Yeah, I barely have time to watch television anyway. The Tour de France has been on the last 3 weeks, and I try and catch sort of the last half an hour of each stage and maybe the highlights. But yeah, I don't have a lot of time to watch television. So yeah, let alone a game of football. Yeah,
Paul, let's talk about your background. Were you a sporty kid growing up?
Yes. Growing up, my main sport was swimming. My mum was a swim teacher, so I was in the swimming pool and competing in swimming galas, from the age of about 10. And then I got into triathlons in my early teens. My mum was a big influence around that time. She was competing in triathlons herself as an age grouper. And I saw her go off to the Gold Coast to race the World Triathlon Championships. I think it was 1991. So, yeah, that was good seeing that as I was growing up. And my dad actually started up the first junior triathlon club in Britain in the early 90s.
Gee, that's incredible. I mean, often I chat to people on the podcast here who come from different sporting backgrounds, not necessarily a swimming, biking, or running. Maybe they played rugby or played a bit of cricket, but it's pretty cool that you've grown up in the sport. It's been part of your life for pretty much as long as you can remember.
Yeah, I was really lucky from that point of view. I was racing. Racing as a junior for Great Britain sort of in the early 90s, and half of the Great Britain youth and junior team was made up of members of the East Grinstead Triathlon Junior Club that my dad started up, which was pretty cool back then.
That is pretty funky. What do you attribute the growth of the sport in the UK to right now? I mean, it's really exploded, hasn't it, Paul?
Yeah. I think the success of the elite athletes, we've always had some of the best athletes in the world. Growing up, it was like Spencer Smith and Simon Lessing, Glenn Cook, athletes like that, helped to grow the sport amongst sort of the juniors. And then obviously in recent years, the Brownleys, Chrissy Wellington, athletes like that. So I think that's really helped to grow the sport. Yeah.
And your favorite? I mean, you've obviously performed well at the Ironman distance level, but what's your sort of favorite distance to race?
Probably Ironman. Yeah. Now that I've moved to Ironman, I like to race that distance. I spent a lot of time racing the standard distance and trying to get faster over that distance. But yeah, so when I turned to Ironman, there's just something very powerful about, you know, crossing that Ironman finish line, you know, that the high that you get from it, that you just don't quite get that high after a sprint or standard distance race. 70.3 is a nice distance because you feel like you're going fast. You can actually race a 70.3 all the way to the line, whereas an Ironman, you know, usually you're sort of dying about halfway through the marathon and you're hanging on to the line. 70.3 is an Ironman is the distances I like.
See, yeah. Some of you are dying halfway through the marathon. Some of us are dying halfway through the bike.
You're obviously pushing too hard on the bike.
Paul, the decision to make the step up to an Ironman distance, for a lot of people who come into the sport very sort of unaware of what's going on and the ins and outs of the sport, and they think, oh, Ironman, that looks good, I'll do one of those. Whereas someone like you who's grown up around it, and the Ironman's a big thing. I mean, it's a long distance, it's a tough race. Was it a difficult decision for you to make that step up, or to make the decision to make the step up?
No, it was from 2006 to 2010. I had sort of five seasons of racing, predominantly standard distance as an age grouper. I was going to European and World Championships each year. In 2010, I got third in the Europeans and fifth at the Worlds. But I just felt like I couldn't train any harder to get any faster over that standard distance, and I needed another challenge. I was a good swim runner, not so good on the bike. So I thought I'll have a little dabble in elite racing. So 2011, I think it was three races in the British Triathlon Super Series, you know, doing sort of draft legal racing. And that was great. Really good sort of learning experience, a lot of fun. But I was, you know, although I was a good swimmer, I was still like a good sort of 1 minute off the lead swimmers. And, you know, I was already swimming 20,000 meters a week. So I just felt like, yeah, I couldn't do any more training because I was working full time. And I thought, well, you know, the next step is Ironman. You know, I'd sort of gone as far as I could over standard distance. I was, working, so I was never going to be good enough doing elite racing. So it seemed like Ironman was the obvious next step.
Let's talk about work and getting that balance right with regards to training for your first Ironman. First up, what do you do for a living, and how do you get that balance right?
Yeah, I'm very lucky now because I'm self-employed. I'm a physiotherapist and I'm a triathlon coach. I do bike fitting, sports massage. I can fit my work around my training. So actually, you know, on a daily basis, my training comes first, and then I fit work around that. When, you know, going back sort of 6 or 7 years when I was doing standard distance racing, I was working as a physiotherapist in an employed job. So, you know, I was having to fit training in early in the morning and in the evenings. So I definitely couldn't have done any more training at that time to go faster over the standard distance.
Do you think that's sort of advisable? Would you say to other age groupers who are possibly listening to this that if they can, to structure their work environment as you have now, that it's a case of your training comes first, you need to fit everything around it, particularly if you want to perform it and get to Kona and perform well at Kona?
Yes. If you can do that, then it's a big advantage. It's a big advantage. If you think, pretty much all the races that we do, we race in the morning. You know, especially if you're doing an Ironman, you're usually starting at 6 a.m. in the morning. So I think it makes sense, you know, to train in the mornings. And if you can work your working day, if you can organize your working day so that you train in the morning and then work afternoons and evenings, then, you know, that just works perfectly for Ironman training.
Paul, tell me about your first Ironman experience. It's a big step up, as I said, from a sprint or an Olympic, even from a half Ironman distance. It's a huge jump. Tell me about your first one. Did it go according to plan? Did you enjoy it? You obviously enjoyed it because you've gone back for more.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. I was extremely worried and anxious about it from the moment I entered the event to the morning of the race. Sort of like 10 months, I think I had that, that sinking feeling that you get every day when you think about something that you're concerned about. I had that feeling pretty much every day. But I think that helped motivate me. The fear of doing the Ironman and the fear of failure in my first Ironman motivated me to do the training, to get out on the bike. My first Ironman was Ironman UK, which is up here in the Greater Manchester area in Bolton. So it was great because I could train on the bike course, and I rode that bike course to death, and that was a big help in getting me around that first Ironman.
Tell me about that fear, Paul. I find that fascinating. What was the driving force behind it?
Yeah, just the fear of the distance, the fear of running a marathon after cycling 112 miles. That worry about getting the nutrition right on the bike. And I think that fear really helped me to become what I would call a student of Ironman, listening to podcasts, reading as much as I could, just to make sure that I got it right on that first event.
Did you?
Yes. Yeah, I did. It was looking back now, it was a really good performance. Yeah. And the goal was just to finish, the goal was just to get round and not make a fool of myself. But I actually ended up about 4 minutes off a Kona slot on my first Ironman. And, I was fit. The performance was good. Looking back now, what I hadn't done is paid attention to all of the marginal gains, And if I go back now and apply all of the marginal gains, I would have easily got a Kona slot on that first performance. But I'm glad that I didn't, because it made me it made me go back and do more Ironmans before I managed to qualify.
Yeah, I also think it's a case of easy come, easy go. If something comes too easy, you don't really value it. And a Kona slot is something special. We'll chat about that in a moment. Talk to me about those marginal gains. What do you mean by that?
Yeah. So when the main thing is when I look at pictures of me on the bike in that first Ironman, and I use it as examples now to the athletes that I coach, and I say, right, look at this idiot on the bike at Ironman UK in his first Ironman. And I was wearing, a standard road helmet with air vents in, so that would have been creating a lot of drag. I had, three bottles on my bike riding up the steep hill. I didn't need three bottles on the bike at that time. I was wearing a long sleeve cycling jersey that was just like a cheap thing that I bought from a local bike shop that was, a bit baggy and would have been creating a lot of drag. Yeah, so things like that. Yeah, had I have paid more attention to my equipment, to my clothing, I would have probably knocked somewhere in the region of 5 to 10 minutes off that bike split, I'm sure.
Wow, that's pretty impressive. Let's talk about getting that Kona slot and then going back after that first Ironman UK and deciding, I want to go for that. That's the goal. How do you go about that? Is it as simple as making a decision and getting to work, or is there a lot more planning and thought that goes into it?
Well, because I was close on that first Ironman, I knew I sort of had the ability to be in that ballpark of a Kona slot, and really it was just a case of just doing another race and just putting yourself in the mix and just seeing what happens. A Kona slot is never guaranteed, and you've just got to be on your best form on race day, and there's an element of luck that comes into it. That that's kind of the approach that I took. Looking back now, I would say, you know, I say to most athletes in Britain that if you're looking to qualify for Kona, probably Ironman UK is it's not the easiest race. It's one of the toughest Ironman races, but it's probably one of the easiest places to actually qualify for Kona. The mistake I made was in terms of qualification was the Ironman that I did after UK was Ironman Austria, which is, you know, a very fast course, attracts a lot of very fast athletes. And I was actually quite a way off a Kona slot on that Ironman in 2014 in Austria. So then the year after last year, I went to Ironman Frankfurt, which is probably another bad decision in terms of the standard. It's probably a step up even from Austria. But I think my influence was more about the experience and doing a fast, good race rather than the Kona slot. I thought if I'm good enough, I'll get the Kona slot. But it was just as much about having a good experience. And I had a decent race at Frankfurt compared to a lot of other people, and because of the heat, and basically got lucky there with my Kona slot.
I find it interesting that you went Austria and then Frankfurt. I mean, I've raced on the continent of Europe, and I use the term race loosely because I'm definitely not a racing snake like you are. But gee, I felt a bit like Miss Piggy at a Wayless, at sort of like a Weight Watchers convention. It was just racing snake after racing snake. It's incredible how, I mean, the athletes and the caliber of athletes that those races particularly do attract.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. There's some very, very good athletes there. But because Ironman Frankfurt is a regional championship race, you get more Kona slots as well. Like there's 75 Kona slots when I did it, you know, compared to 40 at Ironman UK. So, yeah, there's faster, there's better athletes in the race, but, you know, there's more slots per age group. So I had that in the back of my mind. I think actually when I entered Ironman Frankfurt, which, you know, a race like that sells out in a couple of days. So you're literally entering the year before. And when I entered it, I'm sure there was 100 slots. There was 100 Kona slots, and then they reduced that to 75. But it was still just enough for me to get in. Yeah.
Well, I find it interesting that you say that for someone who's possibly a marginal qualifier, UK's is probably a good option. And it is a tough one. I mean, like you rightly say, it's not one of the easiest ones on the circuit. Why do you reckon it's one of I don't want to say an easy one to qualify it, an easier one on the circuit to qualify it with the lesser or the lower amount of slots to like a championship race, as you rightly said.
Yeah. I think the reason it makes it easy, I think maybe because it's a tough course, some of the really fast sort of, you know, Uber bikers, as they call them from Europe, especially Germany, you know, might not want to go to that course because they like doing fast times. So that puts off some of the faster athletes. They don't want to race on a slower course. I think as well, because it's late in the season, it's like, you know, mid to end of July. Some athletes have already qualified in earlier races, such as South Africa, Lanzarote, maybe Austria. So some athletes have already qualified. I think the weather, the British weather, especially the weather in Manchester, puts people off. More often than not, it rains at Ironman UK, so that puts people off. So, yeah, I think there's a number of different factors, yeah.
You've been lucky enough to race at various sort of championship races, not just Ironman distance, as you said, the shorter stuff, European championships. What in your mind makes Kona special?
The history. Yeah, the history. When I was growing up, you know, Mark Allen was my idol. I mean, I remember at age 16 watching the 1992 coverage of the Hawaii Ironman, the NBC coverage that was shown on Eurosport, and it's just brilliant. You know, that the coverage of the 1992 Ironman people who are listening to this show need to look it up on YouTube or whatever and watch that, because it just has everything. You know, it's absolutely brilliant, the coverage there. So I watched that and learned about the Hawaii Ironman, as it was back then. Everyone called it the Hawaii Ironman. Learned about that race from a very early age, you know, sort of mid to late teens. And it just, yeah, it was just always there in the back of my mind that one day I'll race on that course. It was never an obvious goal. It was just like a sort of just a dream, a thought that I knew one day that I would, you know, that I would race on that course. And then I sort of resurrected that dream later in my triathlon career when I'd finished with the standard distance racing.
How cool was it once you had booked your spot, where you had picked up the slot to go? Did it sink in then that you were going to race on that course, or was it only once you had arrived in Hawaii?
It's only once you arrive. the period of time between qualifying and landing in Kona, that period of time, to be perfectly honest, you know, I found it quite stressful. You know, you've got to book your flights, you know, find the accommodation, you've got to recover from an Ironman, and then you've got to train for another Ironman. You know, all of these factors, I was paranoid about, you know, getting ill, getting knocked off my bike. To be honest, it was quite a stressful period. And then as soon as I landed in Kona, and just, I don't know, just like, you know, people talk about, it's a bit of a cliche, but people talk about it being a very spiritual place, you know, very calm island. The people are very calm and laid back. And it just rubs off on you when you're there. It's like, right, you know, I'm here now. You know, I'm not ill, I'm not injured. I've survived the plane journey. My bike's arrived okay. I'm here. And I've got, you know, 10, 12 days before race, and let's start to enjoy it. And it's absolutely fantastic once you actually get there.
You spoke about the fear ahead of your first Ironman. Did you have that same sort of fear leading into Kona?
No. To be honest, that fear never returned after the first Ironman. You know, the fear of completing an Ironman and completing the distance, you know, was gone for subsequent Ironmans. And, you know, definitely going into Frankfurt and again going into Kona, it was much more of a feeling of excitement about the race rather than fear, especially with Kona. Yeah, you can't help but be excited about that, about racing on that course.
Tell me about your race. And once you're there, do you approach this thing to go, you know what, I've qualified, I'm going to work as hard as I can to be as competitive as I can? Or do you approach your first race in Kona the same way as you do your first Ironman and say, you know what, I just want to get through this thing and make sure I enjoy it, and if I come back, then I'll look at racing it? How did you approach it?
Yeah, that's a great question, because you hear so many different things from other athletes, you know, about respecting the big island and all that kind of thing. And you know, how many athletes do you hear about that end up overcooking it and blowing up on their first race? So I must admit, going into the race, I had certain targets in my head that I thought, well, it would be great if I could hit those particular targets. But I think the overriding feeling was that I should just try to enjoy the experience. But yeah, it's one of those things, as I always say with Ironman, you've got to let the race evolve, you know, and you just sort of see what happens during the race. And you know, if you're feeling good, then and the time's looking good, then you might push on. And then if things aren't so good, then you just sort of you can make excuses and just say, well, I'm just going to enjoy the rest of the marathon, that kind of thing.
Have you got unfinished business on the big island?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So the way my race evolved, I had a good swim. I was out of the swim in 62 minutes, which was a little bit slower than Frankfurt. I was out in 58 minutes in Frankfurt, but I think I was obviously enjoying the swim too much, you know, with the looking at the coral and just, you know, I think I did that whole swim with just a big smile on my face. It was absolutely fantastic. So swim was 62 minutes, which was okay. The bike, I was riding to power. You've heard that 100 times before about the importance of power meters. I was riding to power, and that was all okay. But one mistake I made was I had a very flimsy carbon bottle cage on the down tube of my frame, which is where I store my water bottles. And at Kona, they give out these flimsy plastic sports bottles that aren't proper bike bottles. And the first aid station, I picked up one of these flimsy plastic bottles, put it in the down tube bottle cage on the down tube of my bike, and it just went straight through and out the other side, and was then behind me on the road. So I was like, oh no, that's not good. Luckily, I had a better bottle cage on behind my saddle, but that did actually affect me towards the end of the ride, because I lost another bottle at sort of Waikoloa, and you've got about 40k back to town. And as far as I can remember, there was no other aid station from Waikoloa back to town. So I cycled the last 40k without any water. I was riding past bottles on the side of the road, thinking, oh, should I stop and pick one up? But you don't, until you've ridden past a bottle on the side of the road, you don't know whether it's full or empty or whatever. So that, yeah, I've got some, the last 40k of the bike didn't go so well. And then on the run, I kind of enjoyed it too much, running up and down Alihi Drive, and went a bit too fast there, and ended up paying the price as you walk up Palani Drive. Suddenly the sort of 7:30-minute miles became 8:30-minute miles, and then it just got worse from there. So yeah, I've got unfinished business. I'll have to go back and do a better all-round performance next time.
So no pressure, but when are you going back?
When I qualify. When I qualify. It's funny because there's so many, in the UK and in Europe, there's so many good iron distance races that are not, WTC Ironman branded races. We've got one that was this weekend in Nottingham called the Outlaw, which is brilliant. You've got obviously Challenge Roth in Germany. And people say, oh, why don't you do this? Why don't you do that? But I feel like I can't enter an Ironman race unless it's a branded race, because, I want to put myself in the position again that if I have a good race, hopefully that might lead to a Kona slot, and therefore I can go back again. So I think I'll always continue to do, for the time being, Ironman branded events, to give myself a chance of going back to Kona. But I'm not saying, I want to go next year, or I want to go in 5 years' time. When it happens, because I just enjoy training. I'm probably one of those people that enjoys training more than racing. But I'll just pick another Ironman and see what happens.
Knowing what you know now, and with that experience, you mentioned the bottle cage issue, and going back, is there anything you would do differently or change, or what advice would you give to yourself, knowing what you know now, if you could do it over?
Yes, obviously the bottle cage. On the run, I would definitely back off the pace. You've heard it said before that in an Ironman marathon, the first 10 miles come for free. Well, that's quite dangerous out in Kona, because you get those first 10 miles for free up and down Alihi Drive, and you could be flying up and down there. But the race starts after Alihi Drive when you go up Palani, and then you're out into the lava fields. It's just so brutal. So those first 10 miles, you've just got to really, really back off the pace, so that you've got something left, and so that you haven't overheated. I think I probably just overheated. My core temperature went up, so that by the time I got out onto the lava fields, I was just, I was in a bit of a mess, really.
I wanted to ask you that. Was the heat something that you struggled with, or did you find that acclimatization pretty stress-free? You mentioned that you also arrived 10, 12 days before race day. That must have made a bit of a difference.
Yeah, I think, I felt that after about a week of being out there, I'd acclimatized pretty well to the heat. Whether I was acclimatized is difficult to say. I think it's just you learn to deal with the heat. You know, you're sweating constantly, and it's a case of, you know, drink a bottle of a full sports bottle of water before you go to bed. Wake up in the middle of the night, you know, dehydrated. Drink another bottle. Wake up in the morning, drink another bottle. Loads of salt on everything, salt in the water, salt on your food. And I think, you know, that you just learn over the preceding week before the race. You learn, you know, what your body needs in that heat and humidity. I just think you've got to respect the heat and humidity. Everyone is affected by it, some more than others, but the main thing is you've got to slow down on the run, you know, with the movement of the air over your body on the bike. It's not too bad, the heat and humidity, but when you start running, you've got to slow down out there.
Paul, what's the biggest thing you're struggling with triathlon right now? What are you grappling with?
What am I grappling with? Age. Age. I hate to admit it, but things do things do change as you get older. And the thing that is a limiting factor for a lot of triathletes is obviously running injuries. And just because I'm a physiotherapist, it doesn't make me immune from running injuries. So I think that's the biggest challenge. I turned 40 this year, and I just can't do the run training that I could do 5 years ago.
You're over the hill, challenge. Mate. 40, it's downhill from here.
No, it's uphill. It's uphill. My focus now. I've always been a good swim runner, which isn't great as an Ironman athlete, because, as you know, it's all about the bike. So I think what I'm focusing on now, what I'm going to focus on for the next few years, is the bike more and more, to take the pressure off myself to do the running sessions and risk injuries. I'm just going to put a lot more time into the biking. I've been doing a lot more time trialing this year. I think that's the challenge is the injuries, and the solution is doing more biking.
We've got an interesting sort of selection of listeners that listen to this podcast. We've obviously got the group of guys and girls who have qualified and are trying to qualify for Kona. And then we've got a lot of newbies as well, novice triathletes who are thinking about making the step up to doing their first full distance Ironman distance triathlon. What advice would you give to those new guys and girls? Or if you could go back to yourself, knowing what you know now about the sport and Ironman and the distance to the race, what would you tell them?
Well, I think you've got to earn your stripes. You know, you've really got to spend a few seasons doing standard distance, you know, to really get fit and to get faster over the shorter distance and to get lean. We do see a lot of people coming into the sport that maybe are a little bit sort of overweight, a little bit unfit, and I think it's important to get leaner by doing the standard distance before you step up, and then spend a season or two doing a season or two doing 70.3 distance races and then step up to Ironman. You know, don't go from sprint distance to Ironman. You know, work your way up through the distances, get lean, train in that zone two, you know, that fabulous zone two where you're fat burning. That's the zone that the majority of sort of newbie novice athletes should be training in to get their cardiovascular fitness up and to get weight down.
Paul, thank you very much for your time. Much appreciated. I look forward to catching up with you again, where we chat about your swim, bike, your run and some nutrition as well. But we'll save that for another time.
Yep. Okay. Cheers, Brad.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Kona Edge. Don't forget to connect with us on social media. Simply search for the Kona Edge.